Welcome to the CXO Society Show, part of the Change Society podcast. My name's Matt Bradley. I'm a partner at Sullivan & Stanley, better known as S&S, and we are a change and transformation partner challenging traditional management consultancy. The CXO Society is a peer platform for executive change leaders to discuss the future of work. We host a range of community events and roundtables that focus on improving organisations and the executive journey. Today, I'm very fortunate to be joined by Craig Strong. Craig is a Chief Technology and Product Officer specialising in growth and innovation. He has successfully implemented and grown products for a range of organisations and also companies to exit. He's an active member of product and technology communities, including being a Forbes Technology Council member and a global speaker at Lean, Agile and Technology conferences. More recently, Craig has also co-authored a book, The Lean Product Lifecycle, which we'll talk in a bit more detail about today as well. So I hope you enjoy the show. Craig Strong, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You're very good to come in.
No problem, I'm happy to be here.
S&S have dabbled with podcasts in the past, but this is the first of a new series with the CXO Society. So, it's quite a prestigious opportunity for you.
So
when we're 4,000 podcasts in, you can say I was the first.
Brilliant. Yeah. So, hopefully not the last then.
Not the last either. So it's a big week for you, Craig, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a big week. We've got a lot going on, a lot to look forward to on the weekend.
For listeners that are listening on their sunbeds, perhaps in August or something like that, we're actually in the middle of March while we're recording this. It's the final week before the Six Nations Grand Finale, and Wales are 4-0, as they say.
Yeah.
And going for the Grand Slam against Ireland this weekend, and Craig being a proud Welshman is looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think we've got a lot going on in the team at the moment, and it's going to be a big game. It's not an easy one to finish on with Ireland.
Yeah,
but I'm fairly confident.
You're fairly confident.
And hopeful, I suspect.
Yeah. My wife is Irish, so she's obviously going for the men in green.
Okay.
And but I do love the Six Nations. It's a it kind of transcends sport a little bit, and even for people that aren't necessarily mad into sport, I think everyone kind of gets into the tournament.
Yeah.
Celine, my wife, is very passionate when Ireland play. I don't see her that passionate about many things actually as watching Ireland play rugby.
So, yeah.
It should be a good weekend. So. Cool. So, Craig, thanks for joining us, and thank you very much for coming into S&S. Couple of weeks ago, to do a presentation on a recent book that you published, the Lean Product Lifecycle. I'm keen to cover that with you today. Also, a little bit about your career. Keen to get your thoughts on agile management, innovation. Maybe talk a little bit about what you're doing currently as well in the prop tech world. So
great.
But I think it's always good to start at the beginning, really. And learn a little bit about more about you and kind of where you've come from. Tell us a little bit about Craig the Younger, what you were doing growing up.
Yeah, not that long ago.
What did you want to do career-wise growing up and kind of when did you get an interest in technology as well?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question, really. I never really had a conscious, this is what I want to be moment that I don't recall. However, I will say that probably since I could walk, I've been involved with computing and technology, dare I say, from the time of tapes.
Yeah.
So that interest kind of fueled me and having people around me who sort of allowed me to explore technology in different forms. So through my younger years, I was fiddling with computers, early programming, and you had to get into it a bit more, you didn't have the luxury of some of the things you have today, like the early internet. You had to wait for images to appear on screens and so forth. But yeah, that led me to basically pursuing a degree in internet computing, which was a new thing when I took it. And I remember people kind of saying, well, why would you do that? That's not serious programming, yeah. You know, stick with the desktop-based languages. But I was quite interested in distributed computing networks and actually sort of engage in a broader customer audience. So after my degree in that field, went into my background was predominantly a software engineer.
Mm-hmm.
I pursued many contracts in different areas. So ended up working in manufacturing, business intelligence, financial services, small businesses to SMEs initially, and then. That led me on to, I wanted a bigger corporate role, and I joined Hargreaves Lansdown in the earlier days. I was there when it floated on the FTSE 250, which was pretty exciting.
Cool.
Yeah, and that was exposed me to more how you integrate in enterprises with multiple languages, different functions of the business, much more awareness and depth in security and all those things, not just in computing, but the culture around, you know, systems themselves. And from there, went to a younger company based in Cardiff. It was called Tracemart at the time, which eventually got acquired by LexisNexis, looking at ID and AML and solutions in SaaS. And then I was quite excited to move to London at that point. I was already kind of had one foot in London during that time. And I had an exciting opportunity to join Sky, which was a project at the time called Popcorn, which turned into Now TV. So that was really fun. That was, you know, even today we had a really good team and that the culture, and it was, you know, we talk about big agile and scaled agile, and when we were there, there were no such frameworks as such.
Yeah,
you had Scrum and everything else, but we were using very collaborative, you know, 10 to 14 platforms working together without some of those structures in place, and then pursued different careers from there, working in Pearson, enterprise transformation, change, and that led to my where I am today as a CTO, really.
So I'm keen to talk a bit about more about Pearson and your journey there, because I think that's where the seeds for the lean product lifecycle really started to germinate. But I'm kind of keen to pick up quickly on that point around agile you mentioned, because I know obviously you did a lot in terms of software development, and you're in the market before the agile manifesto and the agile values really became a thing. So not to dwell too much on agile, because there's a lot of talk around it, but you know, what's your feeling, and kind of how did you start to get into it?
So basically, as I said, I was a software engineer, and around about probably 2007, 2008 was my moment where I kind of crossed the bridge into agile, peripherally being aware of what was going on and some movements and in XP and different practices. But at that time, you know, I was focused much on the software craftsmanship. And I remember working with a team, and we felt, you know, we were progressing and we were very passionate about our craft. But what we kept coming up against was, despite being, you know, articulate and, you know, improving our craft, we always had this sort of feeling where we were delivering solutions to different customers and the business itself we were in at the time. And there was always a, you know, time pressure with projects, and a lot of the things we would deliver didn't get used or used in a different way. And it would be, you know, a lot of tension and frustration around that time, because we'd learn things later on we wish we knew at the start, but we couldn't change because there were requirements.
Yeah.
So I kind of took the initiative to say there must be a better way of doing this, because we should be able to satisfy, you know, the need and understand value better than we are.
Yeah.
So I explored Scrum particularly back then, and that led me, that was also my transition really from software into sort of leadership and management during that time.
Yeah.
And started to understand coaching and those things.
And so, you know, we fast forward, you know, 11, 12 years now since you kind of really started singing from the Agile song sheet. And there's a number of different frameworks that have come out. You know, there's a number of different companies that have, you know, tried to go agile or, you know, go through transformations. And, you know, there's a little bit of fatigue probably around the market with it at the moment. And not a lot of, you know, some organizations have had great benefits from it, but, you know, probably more have found it a little bit frustrating.
So, yeah. Where
do you think it all went wrong? Because, you know, if you strip it back to the agile values, they make complete sense. So, yeah. you know, why have organizations struggled?
Well, it's an interesting point. I completely agree with you. It's there is a lot of fatigue and frustration. And even the term is, we're going to be more agile. What does that even mean? You know, from my point of view, my own personal experiences and observations, agile, you know, which has a set of principles which are as valid today as they were when they started, focus a lot on people and interactions without actually mandating process. And I think what's happened, if you look at agile today, and I was certainly interested, I'd done a personal sort of investigation into this a couple of years back, and trying to understand exactly this question, what's the frustration, where is it stemming from? And when you start looking at agile, it's become such a broad term. I think it's gone far away from the principles it set out to achieve. And in that broadness, you can actually find every management reference and framework associated to agile.
Yeah.
So it's diluted what agile is. And what you get with that is interpretation, so which becomes meaningless. It
yep.
becomes a conduit or a bridge to actually facilitate other things
yep.
under a banner of agile.
Yep.
Similarly, you've got a lot of processes and you know, certification and everything, which are good in some areas. I'm not saying that there's no value because there's learning to be had in a structured way. But when the goal becomes adherence to process over or at the cost of outcomes, that's a concern for me. And I think that's a risk that businesses should be aware of when applying processes. Mm. What are you trying to do? What problems have you got? And, you know, if you're going to apply a solution, how is that going to help your business? And how will you monitor that continuously? Mm. An interesting piece for me as well, in an agile world, there is the notion of continuous improvement.
Yeah.
And I kind of struggle with the challenge of how can you have process conformity and a principle of continuous improvement? Because for me, a process should be almost like stabilizers on a bike, which get you up and running on the bike. But then as you use the principles and values, you should be free to let go of the stabilizers in a continuous improvement,
yep.
continuous learning way.
Well, that's it. I think I think companies probably talk a little bit too much about transformation and should just do it a little bit more piecemeal, really, and look at those continuous improvements and focus on learning. I know you've released a couple of blogs and different things on creating a learning organization. One of our partners, SNS Adrian, he always says if you can get an organization learning, you're 50% of the way there. So have you got any kind of key ideas or some simple things companies could do to, you know, create that kind of continuous improvement and learning type organization?
Yeah, sure. So I completely agree again on I think wherever you are, whether you're discussing transformation, innovation, growth, or just actually maintaining the business model, continuous learning is absolutely essential.
Mm.
You could have, you know, innovation in your service and customer support models as much as your product organizations and your tech teams.
Yeah.
So for me, any company which is deemed a successful future, I would strongly attribute a property or a principle of continuous learning. But there's loads of things, I think, which can contribute to accelerating or exemplifying a continuous learning culture. And there's some really great studies done with DORA, DevOps Research, with Nicole Fogson, and she wrote the book Accelerate. And,
yep.
you know, she's got 20 points with Jez Humble and so forth on properties which could really help there. But for me, you have to create a culture of trust. You know, if people are learning and they can't apply what they learn, it de-incentivizes the learning path for individuals and teams. The other thing is that everyone talking about learning, but without slack in the system, to learn and giving people time to learn. You're kind of saying, I want you to learn on your own time, which kind of then creates a bit of a frustration. And there's a risk to that, in my opinion. So if you think any given state, there is a process, system, product, wherever that might be, and you're doing things with the best knowledge you know at the time, most cases there's a much better way of doing it, you just haven't discovered it yet. So if you don't have some slack to investigate improving that knowledge or entertaining new ideas that emerge and celebrating those, you'll be basically giving yourself a constraint inevitably, which could be very expensive.
Yeah.
So there's loads of little initiatives you can do, like there's hackathons and things like that.
Yeah. No, and it's that having that room to experiment, I think, which I think more and more organisations are getting that. But as you said, there's always the need to deliver and meet deadlines and bring it in budget and different things as well, isn't there? So cool. So moving on to the book. So this has obviously been a big thing in your life for probably a few years.
Yeah.
We've published a few books here at SNS. I've worked with a couple of C-suite people and change agents that have authored books as well. And so I kind of know the undertaking, but I know a lot of people think they've got a book in them and do think about, getting something out there. So can you just tell us briefly about your kind of journey of writing a book and actually how hard it is, basically?
yeah, absolutely. So in hindsight's a wonderful thing, and I can definitely state that I probably would approach it differently had I known the journey I would have gone on. Writing the book was definitely a big time commitment, more than I expected. And the other thing in our book, because there's three authors, we decided to do it when each of us was on a different continent and time zone, which adds to a nice complexity.
Yeah.
But how it started for us actually was that we were in Pearson doing global digital transformation, and we started in Pearson International, trying to get the enterprise to think more like a startup. And can you do an MVP in weeks to months rather than half a year to a year, and accelerate learning and feedback? So we created some cultures and internal communities, which actually stretched eventually across 19 enabling functions, from finance, safeguarding, efficacy, and so forth. And the book actually was a practical guide for product managers. So the product life cycle itself connects portfolio investment right down to day-to-day product decisions. And what we wanted is to create a step-by-step guide for product managers. And I say guide, not a rule book, to sort of understand what questions to focus on when, as they were ideating, depending on where they were at the life cycle.
Yeah.
And then provide in a language to how they can pitch that back for funding in a meaningful way, which kind of connects those people with the budget and investment to those ideas.
Yeah. And who should read it then? Who is your target audience? Obviously, people within product, but I guess it could be a variety of people within an organization to benefit from it.
So product managers would be confident should get a lot from it.
Yeah.
But I think it should appeal to any enterprise looking to increase the ideation funnel, trying to sort of maybe accelerate learning or the number of ideas you could work on simultaneously without increasing investment. So the full stack of, right up to board level, in fact, how you can manage a portfolio and how you can invest quickly and cheaply to accelerate ideas through portfolio.
Yeah. And it obviously it touches on the, I don't want to call it a buzzword, but innovation. Innovation is on the tip of
the buzzword.
It's the new agile, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm keen to, and this may sound like quite a quite an obvious question, but why is innovation important, especially for large enterprises now? I know there's lots of disruption coming into the market. People don't worry about what brands did for them, yesterday. They care about you know, what a platform or something can do for them today. But, you know, what's your view on why innovation is so important?
Yeah, so innovation, I would say, you know, is critical for enterprises to be aware of right now. What we're seeing is, whereas, you know, go back 20, 30 years, the size mattered and, you know, the size of your enterprise and the reputation and customer loyalty you had would allow you to build a moat and protect future revenue. Mm. In the last 10 years, digital disruption has transformed that to challenge enterprises on all fronts. And what we've seen there is, whereas enterprises usually competed against enterprises, actually, you've now got bigger pockets collectively in venture capital than any enterprise, investing in a massive and wide range of portfolios, building the companies of tomorrow. Mm. So threats are coming from all directions for enterprises, not just against other enterprises. And therefore, if innovation isn't in the longer-term strategy of the company, you'll be in a reactive space. And just with the digital capabilities that we've got today, the cost of switching is much lower. So if you've got customer loyalty, they will be able, in most cases, to actually switch to newer competitive products yep. quite quickly, which yeah. is a real threat for long-term revenue.
Yeah, and I think that at just to give everyone a view, Craig. Craig spoke a few weeks ago for us on how to create an ambidextrous enterprise for sustainable innovation and growth. And I know you sort of case studied shortly at Amazon as a very good ambidextrous organization. So, well, why is that? Obviously, you know, everyone's seen them taking over a number of different markets. But what makes them so special?
Well, what I quite like about Amazon is that they see growth as a survival tactic. They don't see growth as an objective or a strategic need. You know, it is just part of normal operations. What I like, which speaks to that, is, you know, Amazon, we all know the stories, online books, started the store,
yep.
became a global brand. But then they started, one of the biggest revenue verticals right now is AWS. So there's an internal capability which they thought, well, let's release that as a product. So, you know, they monetized an internal function they had, which is now one of the biggest revenue verticals. And if you look at the irony, you know, they've actually gone into bricks and mortar in some cases. And
yeah.
So they don't seem to have a fear or hesitation of, this is not our strategy, we're going to just play in this space. They seem to actually go on all fronts. And I think I'm friends with a number of people in principal innovation roles there, and they have very interesting, strong links with their customers and users. So they yeah. build quite close relationships. They work on a lot of fronts. They ideate and communicate that, and basically are able to build the future company on ideas which haven't yet emerged. But as soon as they do, they can capitalize on it.
They're really getting very close to your customers and trying to deliver value to them quickly, which is obviously one of the key Agile principles. Yeah. So, cool. I guess what I'm quite keen to drill down a little bit more into the lean product lifecycle and for you to give a bit more detail on that. But before that, I'm quite keen to touch on management, really, and leadership, because, you know, I think Amazon is a good barometer for this. But, you know, in the market we talk a lot about technology innovation, product innovation, capability innovation. We don't talk a huge amount about management innovation, and I think that's where maybe a lot of enterprises struggle in terms of that. So what's your view on, you know, leadership and management, and why aren't companies putting enough emphasis on innovating those, you know, quite traditional practices?
Yeah, well, it's the governance and the management practices that were, you know, taught to a lot of the leaders today are, in my opinion, no longer relevant or outdated. So there is the world shift around some of those capabilities in management which haven't adapted. So I think that's, and inevitably, you know, in 10 years' time, the stuff we're talking about today will probably succumb to the same. But What I would say is that generally when I speak to boards and, larger companies, they're very much aware of the need to innovate. They actually worry about it. They actually look to invest in it and they strategize. So it's not something which they're dismissive of at all. But I think what happens, from my observation, is the layer down from that often misinterprets it and falls into a traditional governance set, which is command and control and variance management and annual budgeting, which constrain reactions and responsiveness of the organization. And because that's how management is measured performance-wise, it will, and personal incentives and everything are still attached to those things, it can actually, impair or restrict the capability for growth and innovation. So it's that middle bit which I see the most constrained. And the other piece to that, which I would say speaks to the culture of management there, and not in all cases, but in a lot of cases, is that in times of uncertainty, people regress to comfort. And when you actually see big plans and forecasts and budgets, there is a belief, should you say, in that I feel okay again, I can see a plan. But you can't plan, long term or even medium term in an area where you're being disruptive or in a competitive space or in an innovative space. So we need, in my belief, to change the management philosophy and practice to be much more adaptive and responsive and actually come up with new measurements on, how many ideas they're working on, what's the average time of the ideas before you prove a business model, how is it sticking with customers, and how is it resonating, and very much like you would see in a venture capital mindset and how they invest and are able to sort of make decisions quite quickly, what to bet on and what not to bet on.
Yeah, which leads us on quite nicely, I guess, to the lean product lifecycle, which I know you're conscious not to call a framework. I guess, do you want to just give us like a brief overview? Because there's six stages, idea, explore, validate, grow, sustain, and retire. As you said, a lot of the thinking came from working at Pearson, where a lot of this was matured. It's, it's based on, a bit of a VC type model as well. So do you want to explain the difference and an approach? Because I know you although there's six phases, but the first three and the second three are slightly different as well. So do you want to give everyone a bit of an overview?
Sure. So the behind the lean product life cycle, a lot of the inputs we use, come from lean startup, agile, and just modern management practice in many respects. So the lean product life cycle is a combination of those things. But what we try to do is ask the right questions at the right time. So principally, the lean product lifecycle is that, where are you in the product lifecycle? What is the most important thing to ask now? And what's the minimum? How can you apply minimum effort to learn what you need to know at any stage? So, a product lifecycle itself is not a new concept, 60 years old, marketing heritage and so forth. What we were challenged with is how, going back to the previous point, how can we minimize the upfront planning and reduce the investment so we can open up the funnel and work on more ideas at the same time without significantly or even increasing the investment. So we created a six-stage product life cycle, and I would say the first three stages, idea, explore, validate, are the exploration and discovery engine. And grow, sustain and retire at the later stage. So maybe if I break that down, it'll give you the context there. So firstly, idea. Idea is, a lightweight sort of pitch. We had it so it was just two pages submission. You would, can you answer these questions? Focus on, is it aligned to strategy? What's the market need? Have you done some exploration? Have you spoken to any customers with this need? What have you learned? That kind of thing. And that created enough to sort of have a conversation or pitch to a board. I've got this idea. Here's some evidence around this idea. I would like some investment.
Yeah. I think you mentioned the other day, I'd just like an iPad, please.
Yeah, so exactly. So maybe I'll mention that in Explore. Yeah. So what the purpose then is that by having that conversation with a product council or investment board, they'll be able to sort of make a decision whether it's on strategy and it's interesting, and there's enough there to sort of say, okay, now let's explore that, which is the next phase. And exploration is all about not building anything as such, but actually developing a better understanding of the customer need, research, disposable experiments and engagements.
Yeah.
And we had a guide to say, in this case, this in an enterprise, this was up to $50,000. You know, that could change. But like anything, if you say up to, people usually say, or in our experience, I'd like $50,000, and it's, you know, that's
obviously,
not yeah, obviously, yeah. but that's not how it worked. And you know, we would have some coaches to sort of work with the idea and support people with that. And to that reference on the iPad, I remember a case where someone asked for obviously the $50,000, and actually it just when we broke it down with the coaches, all they needed was to borrow an iPad, install a couple of, you know, off the shelf apps, and actually just get them in front of customers.
Yeah,
and then through the explore phase, you come back with a clear set of questions answered, go back to the investment council with some evidence that you've explored that. And then with that evidence, if you're successful and you've learned that it's worth continuing, you would be pitching whether to continue, pivot, or stop. Pivot would be, I've learned something more interesting, I'd like to do it again or further my research. And that would lead you to validate the third phase. And the validate stage is then building more of a team, a smaller team, albeit, to build what is a minimum viable product and then sort of validate the business model further. So you're testing whether you have the capabilities to actually create a product to solve that customer need in the very, very minimum sense. Again, as you get to the end of validate, the purpose there is you would be able to demonstrate that you have a viable business model to invest in, and essentially, in simple terms, you're saying, here's the business model. If you give me $10, I'll give you $20 back for every customer, and this is the market size that we want to go for, and that would be
so where it transitions. Yeah, it's a pitch for a light investment, a light governance, and you're kind of pulling it together by this point, or as you say, asking the right questions to drop it as well. So, and then the second, the second three stages.
Yes. So I should note in the first few stages, we would in explore. You know, this would be a couple of weeks to a month.
Right.
And validate, we'd advocate less than 3 months. You know, this is as
quick as you can. Delivering value every 90 days type thing.
Pretty much. Yeah. At that point, when you've actually gone back, it's then a bigger business decision because you've got some evidence. You've reduced risk because through the smaller investment and the feedback, it's an evidence-based model. So now you're actually saying, you know, well, I've got more certainty potentially than a plan you would have previously asked for to grow this business or product.
Yeah.
So this is where now you basically are transitioning into a scalable business. And you start building the team to actually then accelerate market penetration and product growth as you would somewhat traditionally. And that could continue. The timescale changes there because you could be in there for years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think you mentioned as well, it's kind of that second phase is, you know, where enterprises actually already have a lot of the tools and, you know, there to really kick on with when any ideas and kind of where they have an advantage over those, you know, startups and challengers in the market as well. So if they can get that first phase correct and bet on the right horses, so to speak, then they should be in a good place. So, I mean, just a final point on that really is I think you quote VCs reckon between 75% and 90% of investments fail. Something like that. So,
yeah.
I mean, if you're an enterprise, if you're a CEO, you know, why should they take that risk, I guess?
Well, it's interesting. The model I just talked about is actually based very much on the VC's thinking, you know, spread wide cheaply and then double down with evidence. And yeah, it's a frightening number for most people. 75 to 90% of the ideas you're talking about will fail. But I actually think it's higher in enterprise. So this is what's interesting. The difference being is enterprises bet big up front, and they get into often a stage where they, when things are not working so well, they will double down on it.
Yeah.
What VCs are good at is when something doesn't work, they will stop it and they'll invest in the next idea. So I would say, conversely, enterprises have a higher percentage of risk than VCs.
Yeah.
Because they don't have an approach to developing products which allows them to stop and actually work on more ideas simultaneously.
Yeah. So you can really flip that question around, I guess, and put it back on them. So cool. So it's a good, obviously, hard work writing the book, but an enjoyable experience. Do people treat you differently now you're a published author?
No, not at all.
Do you get autographs on the street or anything?
No, I'm actually, generally, unless we're engaging specifically on it, I don't mention it, but what I do like is that one of the motivations for me writing the book was not so much of writing the book for in a popularity sense. It's actually to meet interesting people. You know, I'm a continuous learner, and I found that one of the benefits for me actually writing the book, people have reached out and said, oh, I've had similar thoughts, that's interesting, I've tried this, so I've definitely furthered my own knowledge and connections.
Yeah, there. I think there's a certain thing about becoming an author. You become an influencer in the market, so to speak. So you do get kind of more people wanting to talk to you and a little bit more inbound. So, you know, it can play to your want to continuously learn, as you say. So, cool, Craig. Well, look, you know, we've got 5 minutes left or something like that. So I'm keen to touch on, you know, what you're up to now, really. You're at a newer company called Settled in the prop tech space.
Yeah.
As someone that's just bought a new property and having to gone through the rigmarole of buying a property and the conveyancing process and everything, I know that there's a huge amount of pain in that market. So, you know, what's happening and are you fixing it?
Yeah, we're fixing it. it's an interesting thing. I'm quite motivated and I really like the prop tech space at the moment. I think there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of developments happening. So I'm at Settled and we've got some interesting things in the pipeline we're actually going through at the moment. But generally the prop tech space, and particularly in the UK, is a little bit stagnant or behind the times. And when you think that, you know, for most people, the majority of people, actually buying a house is the biggest single investment they make and something which has a huge emotional attachment, not just a financial attachment.
Yeah.
It's not an insignificant decision to make. Yet, you know, we have very little data around properties. There's a lot of guesswork, you know. It takes, I think, on average 19 weeks from the point of offer in the UK to completion. 30% of those don't go through. So it's a lot of pain in that. And you know, it's one of the most stressful things in people's lives.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be that way. You know, you can go into, a Ferrari garage and spend roughly the same amount and walk out of there with, you know, a car in the... If you had the ability to, with loads of data and everything around it, why can't you do that with a property? Mm. So when you combine things like IoT, fragmented ownership, where you can, you know, challenge the way that people have mortgages and have, you know, in social investment into houses, there's a lot of opportunity for people to innovate in this space.
Yeah, there's lots of opportunities, isn't there? Yeah. Cool. So it's great spending time with you. Final question. Keen to ask everyone this that comes on the show. So, you know, we've touched on innovation and disruption in the market and, you know, companies needing to, you know, move the dial. So where do you see the kind of the future of work in 5 years' time, say, in 2024? You know, what does the business and technology landscape look like?
So it's exciting. I think you know, inevitably you'll see a lot of companies, I think, that we're familiar with today, we're not around at that point, who haven't innovated in a way to make them interesting and have been disrupted. And that will be across all sectors. You know, I don't think there's a specific area that's alone in that. But I think there's what's also interesting is there's a stronger awareness now of company ethics, and you know, people are, because a lot of products are commoditized, people are much more aware where they invest. So I think there's going to be a stronger stance on companies investing in social innovation and so forth. So that's going to be an interesting thing to observe, how people, how customers react to that. But technology-wise, I think, you know, this is a really exciting time. This is, you know, digital is everywhere and more so, and it's not slowing down. VC's pockets are getting bigger, so more ideas are coming through, particularly in Europe, it seems to be getting more interested in that space. So I think we're in for a turbulent but enjoyable ride.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be interesting. And who knows? Cool. Well, look, Craig, you're a gentleman for coming in. Really enjoyed the chat. Go out and buy Craig's book that he co-authored. Do you want a quick shout out to the other authors as well?
Yeah, Tendai Vicky and Sonia Krutojevic. Tendai particularly does a lot of great blog posts as well. It's worth following if you're interested in this space.
Yeah, go and check it out. It's on Amazon. And Craig's a good guy and always open for coffee. So,
do like my coffee.
He does like his coffee. Good stuff. Right, thanks, Craig. Enjoyed that.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Hi, everyone. Hope you enjoyed the show. If you're interested in hearing more about the CXO Society, connecting executives globally, then please visit our website, thecxosociety.com, and register your interest, and I will be in touch.